From VOA, Press Conference USA, here is your host, Carol Castiel.
Welcome to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Joining me on the program is Siamak Dehranpour, broadcaster in VOA's Persian service. Our topic, a deep dive into Iran. Our guest, Hussein Banai, professor of international studies at the Hamilton Lugar School of Global and International Studies at Indiana University. According to his website, Hussein Banai was born and raised in Tehran until the age of 15. Thereafter, he grew up in Toronto, Canada. Professor Banai holds a master's degree from the London School of Economics and Political Science and a doctorate from Brown University in Rhode Island. His research interests are at the intersection of political thought and international relations, with a special focus on topics in democratic theory, U.S.-Iran relations, and Iran's political development. Banai is author or co-author of several acclaimed books on Iran, in particular, Becoming Enemies, U.S.-Iran Relations, and the Iran-Iraq War, 1979 to 1988. His forthcoming book is entitled Republics of Myths, National Narratives, and the U.S.-Iran Conflict. Before we get into our interview with Professor Banai, a very quick update on Iran and U.S.-Iranian relations. Since the Islamic Revolution in 1979, which overthrew the Pahlavi monarchy, U.S.-Iranian ties have been strained for decades. From the Iran hostage crisis, in which militants held 52 American hostages for more than a year, the Iran-Iraq War between 1980 and 1988, to the Trump administration's decision in 2018 to withdraw from the 2015 Iran nuclear accord and impose sanctions as part of a maximum pressure campaign, U.S.-Iranian relations have been characterized by enmity and mistrust. A Shia-majority Persian country in a predominantly Sunni Arab region, Iran has managed to exert considerable influence over the past 40-some years. The 2003 U.S.-led invasion of Iraq ushered in a veritable Shia revival, a term used by Iranian-born scholar Vali Nasser. By removing Saddam Hussein and disbanding the Ba'athist security forces, the United States paved the way for Iran to cement its ties with the large and neglected Shia population of Iraq. In addition, in 2014, when the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant overran a large portion of Iraq, Iran played a major role in their eventual defeat, a rare point of strategic convergence between Tehran and Washington. However, Shia militias or other Western-designated terrorist organizations like Hezbollah and until recently the Houthis in Yemen, supported by the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, have caused further friction with the United States and its ally, Saudi Arabia. So in light of the June elections in Iran, widely viewed as rigged, which brought to power the hardline cleric Ibrahim Raisi, a protege of Supreme Leader Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, what are the prospects for reviving the Iran nuclear deal, a stated objective of the Biden administration? We will ask our special guest, Professor Hussein Banai, who joins us via Microsoft Teams. Hussein Banai, welcome to the program.
Hi, it's wonderful to be with you.
And I'm very delighted to welcome Siamak Dehranpour, a popular broadcaster in VOA's Persian service.
Carol, thank you for having me on your show.
So Professor Banai, recently elected hardline cleric, Iranian President Ibrahim Raisi, made his debut on the world stage at the 76th session of the UN General Assembly with a rather fiery anti-American speech. But he did start his speech with the phrase, "Iran is the land of culture and civilization, and the most progressive in West Asia," which is a bit haughty, but nonetheless, there's a kernel of truth in all of that. What should we glean from his remarks about the direction of Iran, both domestically and externally?
Yeah, I think the speech was actually rather consistent with what Iranian presidents have in the past presented both their country, but also their specific agenda before the world community. The press reports of the speech have characterized it as fiery or antagonistic even, but I think that's largely attributed to the fact that he arises out of a different faction within the Iranian political system that has been more blunt in terms of its framing of its political agenda, contrasted to the more mild-mannered, Western-educated members of other factions within the regime. But the message essentially has always been the same, which is to depict Iran as a great civilization, not just as a country, as one that has every right before it to act in the manner that it does in the region, influencing other countries around it, Shia groups in the Arab world, etc. But also one that has serious grievances against the way it's been treated, especially since the revolution, by Western powers, most notably the United States. So I thought Raisi hit very familiar themes in his speech. Obviously, his person underlines the hardline tone, just as it did with previous more hardline presidents such as Mahmoud Ahmadinejad. But the substance of the message is the same. This is the Islamic Republic trying to project itself as a protector of a civilizational identity, while at the same time, one that has been stalled and sabotaged and isolated by Western powers, especially the United States.
Many analysts are saying that this is a very hardline regime. And even though we know that the real power rests with Ayatollah Ali Khamenei, Ibrahim Raisi is shaped in his image. But how different will this regime be from your perspective from the previous one, which was ostensibly run by more moderates? And what about the challenges that face the country, whether the COVID pandemic, the economic decline, and of course now criticism it's facing from ramping up the nuclear program?
As you noted in the wonderful introduction you gave in terms of the background of the Islamic Republic, when it comes to the substance of the foreign policy of the Islamic Republic of Iran, this administration is no different than the previous ones in that it has to maintain the same discipline that previous administrations have had, which ultimately is handed down to them by the Office of the Supreme Leader. And the decisions that are made in Tehran and within the apparatus of the Supreme Leader's office. In terms of domestic politics, that's where you find differences between this administration and probably the previous administrations. There's no question that the cabinet of Ebrahim Raisi is more hardline, and the policies are kind of a throwback to the pre-reform era of so much more censorship, controlling of domestic institutions at the behest of the Office of the Presidency, and altogether a firmer hand in punishing the dissidents of the regime. Going back to foreign policy, I think some of the notable differences will probably be in the interpersonal skills that some of the key appointees of this administration bring to the table in their contacts with outside powers. There's no question that the previous administration, the Rouhani administration, had a cohort of Western-educated, charming functionaries who did really well ingratiating Iranian interests to Western countries, much better than any cohort previously had done. Obviously, that's reset now. The foreign minister and the foreign ministry officials do not have the same level of interpersonal skill or talent to be able to present not only a different dimension of the Islamic Republic, but also frame their agenda in a manner that would get their particular grievances a fair hearing in Western capitals and in the Western media. How this would impact Iran's handling of its most momentous international files, such as the nuclear program, remains to be seen. But then again, the substance of the foreign policy has not changed. There's continuity there. Everything that I've read and all the news reports that we hear in terms of how this administration is approaching those files and these preliminary phases indicate that it's basically continuing on with the same kind of halting, slow-moving approach to negotiations as the previous administration was doing in the latter years that it was in office.
I'd like now to turn to my colleague Siamak Dehanpour for a couple of questions.
Thank you, Carol. Thanks for having me on your great show. Professor Banai, thank you for taking the time to talk to VOA. I would like to begin by asking, is Raisi, in your opinion, an Ahmadinejad 2.0, another version of Mahmoud Ahmadinejad, former Iranian president? And considering the fact that the JCPOA is not popular among some in Iran, are they looking for an excuse to let it die and then come up with something new, or this is a tactical game to extract more concessions from the U.S.?
Great questions. I don't think he is Ahmadinejad 2.0. Raisi comes into office with a far heftier political network behind him than Ahmadinejad did at the time. So in terms of his status within the hierarchy of the Islamic Republic domestically, he's a world apart from Ahmadinejad, who was a lowly mayor of Tehran, who talked a big game, but when it came to actually executing, was a total subordinate. This doesn't mean that Raisi isn't ultimately subordinate to what comes out of the Office of the Supreme Leader in terms of important decisions. But having served in fairly important positions, such as the head of the judiciary, the head of one of the wealthiest foundations in the country, it is very clear that he has his own particular political leverage that he can bring to the table. Whether any of that translates into a unique profile in terms of Iran's foreign policy, I'm highly skeptical of that. I think what Raisi brings is an alignment with the Supreme Leader's, Ali Khamenei's, perspective and foreign policy doctrine of resistance, engagement only when it suits the preservation and stability of the Islamic regime inside Iran, and nothing much more beyond that. In terms of the approach to the nuclear file, I think the ultimate goal of this administration, as it was in the case of Ahmadinejad, as it was in the case of Rouhani and others, although Rouhani case is more complicated because a deal had to be reached at some point for a new projection of Iran's framing of the nuclear issue. But throughout the life cycle of Iran's nuclear program, I think the Islamic Republic's objective has been to engage with the West in a manner that would always result in a stalemate, not significant progress so that the regime would be exposed and then would have to make extra domestic concessions or regional concessions. But at the same time, not too much disruption that it would force the regime in a corner where it would be vulnerable to a military attack from outside. So a kind of an equilibrium between those two positions, a stalemated position where everyone is dissatisfied. That's the place where I think the Islamic Republic feels most comfortable in having its nuclear file progress, because it allows them to have control over the narrative, both domestically and increasingly in the region and beyond as well.
You're listening to Press Conference USA on the Voice of America. Our guest is Professor Hussein Banai. He's professor in international relations at the Hamilton Luger School of Global and International Studies at Indiana University. I'm Carol Castiel, along with Siamak Dehanpour, senior broadcaster in VOA's Persian service, and we're discussing Iran, its current internal and external political dynamic. This is a reminder that our Press Conference USA podcast is available for free download on our website at voanews.com/PCUSA. You may also follow us on Twitter or connect with us on Facebook at Carol Castiel, VOA. Well, here's a shout out to a loyal listener, Shaista Khan Ahmadzai from Patia, Afghanistan. If you want to hear your name and home country on the air, please send an email to PCUSA@voanews.com or like us and leave a comment on our Facebook page. Well, speaking of Afghanistan, let me ask you very briefly, Professor Banai, do you think there's going to be any impact from the U.S. withdrawal from Afghanistan on Iran's role in the region? How does Iran see the Taliban regime? Is this a welcome development? I assume so, insofar as you have the U.S. out of the country. But what are the other challenges, particularly with regard to refugees who seem to be seeking haven in Iran?
Yeah, I think this is a very complex foreign policy file for Iran. It has always been a difficult issue in that there's no question that Iran would like to see the United States military presence in Afghanistan significantly reduced and removed ultimately. But that means that Iran now has to define what its national interests are vis-a-vis the Taliban. And that historically has been very difficult for the Islamic Republic to do. The Iranian government under the reformist Mohammad Khatami almost went to war prior to the 9/11 attacks with the Taliban, who killed Iranian diplomats inside Afghanistan. In addition to the refugees problem, which for Iran is a major issue, there's also the issue of the opium trade and drug cartels that operate between Iran and Afghanistan and have caused sufficient instability in Iranian provinces to the east. But all indications are that Iran is trying to bide its time and see exactly how the Taliban would settle into power. And they're taking their cues from China, Russia, and India, who also are recalculating their position vis-a-vis Afghanistan. Iran historically has been a very patient observer of its neighbors to the east, and indications here are that they're doing the same here. The framing has been that this has been a welcome development, that finally the United States has left the region. And they have tried to signal that they would like Afghanistan to be a stable country and that they would help in any way they can. Obviously, they're very concerned, especially about the Hazara population in Afghanistan, which have suffered terribly under the Taliban previously. And news reports indicate that Taliban are moving on them in the same way as well. But Iran does not have the appetite to project any military power into Afghanistan at this point. It's already overstretched to its western borders in terms of how it's trying to influence Shia militias operating inside Sunni Arab countries to its west. And so this would be quite an overstretch for it to get involved in Afghanistan in any serious way.
I'd like to turn to Siamak for another question.
Thank you, Carol. Professor Banai, what's the optics of dealing with Raisi with his horrible human rights background while he was the head of the judiciary? As you know, they executed a journalist, an athlete, and when he was an AD in charge, he was very instrumental in mass execution of Iranian prisoners. What is the serious challenge here facing the Biden administration dealing with Raisi?
It's a major issue. It's one that, frankly, I don't think the White House has given much thought to, at least in terms of the public pronouncements that have come out of the State Department and at the UN in terms of what the United States wishes to prioritize in dealing with Iran. It's the nuclear file, nuclear file, nuclear file. But as you mentioned, Raisi is not just any ordinary functionary within the Islamic Republic. He has a fairly dark history as a member of the Death Commission that sent scores of dissidents, journalists, activists to their deaths during the first decade of the Islamic Republic, the consolidation period of power. And that report card so far has not received sufficient attention in international forum. Someone who is not just accused, but there is credible evidence, voice recordings of him participating in the mass killing of dissidents is, according to international law, someone who's accused of crimes against humanity. That's the highest crime that a head of state could be charged with. And so the optics are really troubling if there is any legitimacy bestowed on him as someone which the Western powers would like to deal with directly. The Europeans have also shied away from this. And I think everyone is so eager to deal with just the bare minimum security concerns they have with Iran that they don't want to go further into these dimensions. But the Biden administration has said that it would very much like to put human rights and democracy at the center of its foreign policy once again. So when you consider that context as well, this is a very troubling development. Having said that, there are sanctions on Raisi in place. Whether they should now opt to control his movements internationally, there's already a file at The Hague opened against him. But whether he should be prosecuted if he travels to a country that could indict him to the world court or not, those are the kinds of issues that the State Department is in a very tricky spot to comment on. But nevertheless, if they're putting human rights at the center of foreign policy, should speak louder on.
Since Iran, Professor Banai, is facing an environmental crisis, 25% unemployment rate among 15 to 24 years old, and 45% inflation rate, and lots of other challenges ahead of this Raisi government, do you think Iran can keep up with the domestic challenges and regional ambitions that you were just referring to under international sanctions?
Well, that's been a very interesting puzzle. You have two sets of dynamics that are going in opposite directions. One is Iran's aspiration to project power in the region and to support militarily, monetarily, Shia militant groups in Sunni Arab countries. And the other is this kind of worsening economic environmental situation inside Iran and government resources being unable to meet those. Those contradictions historically in any country have not resulted in a situation whereby the state is able to hold its line or the same objectives for much longer. And yet Iran has muddled through this for the last decade or so, and they're looking at different ways to prolong continuing with these two same contradictory objectives into the short term as well. I've seen no indications out of this new government that they're willing to scale back from their activities in Iraq, Syria, southern Lebanon, in Yemen, etc. They have joined the Shanghai Pact now, so they're hoping to get some sort of economic benefits out of China as much as possible, funding these difficulties, domestic and regional, through the sale of oil to China increasingly seems to be the strategy they're going down for. But as China's economic troubles also trend upward. It's unclear how much longer they can continue this, especially since China has all the leverage in that relationship and Iran has none of it. So if the Chinese just choose not to pay or delay payments, they could very easily do that as well. Iran is highly, highly, highly exposed in that trade relationship with China. It's a conundrum that, frankly, I don't think the Islamic Republic has a very good answer to. And they're hoping that by just muddling through and maintaining their grips on power, they will get past it until some other dynamic regionally happens that they could reap some advantages from. But the contradictions are too great. And if I were a betting person, I would bet against the ability of the state to be able to continue this much longer.
Professor Banai, notwithstanding human rights abuses by the Islamic Republic, and of course Raisi in particular, Iran is simply not the source of all bad behavior in the Middle East. We do have to recall that U.S. ally Saudi Arabia was implicated in the murder of journalist Jamal Khashoggi, its horrific bombardments of Yemen and other types of atrocities. Nonetheless, here we are. If you were to advise President Biden, you already said that more emphasis should be placed on human rights. What would you recommend, given so many challenges, to normalize or improve the U.S.-Iranian relationship, whether rejoining the nuclear accord or trying to combat Iran's malign activities in the region vis-a-vis its support for Hezbollah and other militias, even in Iraq, which have been criticized?
That's a wonderful question. I think it's very clear that when it comes to Iran's rationale for its foreign policy, the Islamic Republic's rationale for the foreign policy that it has pursued, whether its nuclear program or its approach to regional countries to its west, that domestic considerations are intricately linked with those projects abroad. Therefore, any policy that puts a hard border between, let's say, arms control or curbing Iran's regional ambitions and what goes on with respect to Iran's record on human rights is bound to fail because the two are intimately connected. Iran's pursuit of nuclear weapons, which they denied, we should say, they say they only want it for peaceful purposes, but the IAEA reports and various third parties have exposed the existence of the military dimensions of that program, which has brought Iran to the negotiating table over the years. The pursuit of that program has everything to do with the stability and ultimate survival of the Islamic regime in Iran. Now, that survival is important for the leaders inside Iran because ultimately it's a system that is very hierarchical and gives very little popular input into the day-to-day governance of the country. So anything that gets the society destabilized is something that's of deep concern to the Iranian leaders. If the United States were to formulate a policy singularly based on human rights and does not look at Iran's power projection or its material capabilities, obviously that would be at a cost to strategic interests of the United States in the region. And nuclear-armed Iran basically makes it a moot point in terms of what goes on inside Iran. At the same time, any policy that singularly looks at Iran's nuclear program and its regional ambitions and downplays human rights and democracy fails to see what the ultimate goals of those programs are. So if I were advising the Biden administration, I would urge them to formulate a detailed policy, which the previous two administrations have not. The Obama administration that engaged the Islamic Republic in the first place, and then the Trump administration that completely disengaged altogether, really showed the opposite poles that I just talked about. The Biden administration has an opportunity to formulate a detailed policy of what exactly they mean in terms of their red lines on Iran's handling of its nuclear file, its regional ambitions, and also what they expect of Iran when it comes to the treatment of its citizens, dissidents, dual nationals, etc. They've been very coy about putting anything forward in the latter camp. That's been one of the, to me, saddest consequences of the post-Iraq invasion geopolitical picture in the Middle East, in that so much attention has been focused on the strategic picture and so little on human rights and democracy, actually. And now we're at a point that everything is solely looked through the lens of national interest. So we need a detailed policy on Iran. What exactly are United States asks on each of these things, and an articulation of how they relate to each other and what the consequences would be if Iran behaved in a manner that we would regard as being in violation of international humanitarian law, as well as in violation of the Non-Proliferation Treaty and Iran's obligations under JCPOA.
Well, that is complicated and very nuanced. I hope our diplomatic community can step up to the plate and consider that. But let me now turn to Siamak for yet another question.
Thank you, Carol. Professor Banai, there are reports that Iranian Quds Force trains, funds, and equips several separatist groups in Africa and provides training to Shia groups, including the Islamic Movement of Nigeria. Iran has also used its ties with some African countries to bypass the economic sanctions. In your opinion, what is it that Iran is mainly pursuing in Africa? Is it the competition with Saudis, the smuggling networks in those countries? What are your thoughts on this?
A bit of all those. I think just as Iran's strategy in the Middle East in its beginning phases in the late 80s and early 90s was all about just testing how much leverage they could gain by funding seemingly disparate groups of militants that were roughly aligned with Iran's interests. Iran is testing the ground in Africa similarly as well. I think they would like to have probably in that scenario, in that region, first and foremost, an easier access to smuggling networks, which is way more important. It's more of a lifeline for Iran's Revolutionary Guards right now than anything else is in terms of ideology or in terms of the ideology of anti-colonialism, anti-imperialism, or balancing Saudis. There's not much there that Iran could gain. But having smuggling routes open in case the guards are under strain and need to call on certain groups to help them with the shipment of arms or even money laundering, those networks would be reliable when it comes to those factors. I should note here that what is central here is the Revolutionary Guards. The Islamic Republic Revolutionary Guards Corps runs these channels without any oversight whatsoever by the executive branch, the presidency. And even when it comes to the Office of the Supreme Leader, there's very tenuous control. They have their own clandestine budget. They have their own priorities. And they operate very much in a way that smuggling networks do themselves when it comes to many countries, not just in Africa, but also in East Asia as well. Countries such as Thailand and Malaysia and Singapore, they have kind of perfected these networks of access to fast cash, weaponry, spy networks, etc. So I would imagine the objective behind those are far more material and bluntly strategic than they are anything having to do with ideology or support for sectarian minorities.
Thank you. Carol, back to you.
Well, in the very few minutes we have left, Professor Banai, do you think that the targeted assassination by the Trump administration of Qasem Soleimani, the head of the IRGC, did that backfire in your view, thinking that if he was gone, you know, things would be different with respect to the support for terrorism? How do you see that?
Well, at the time, I think characterized that assassination by the Trump administration as akin to shooting first and then aiming later. To call it counterproductive would be to vastly underestimate just how little thought actually went into the execution of that plan. And there was much reporting on this on the timeline of the decision-making by President Trump. There was actually very little thought that went into that action. A target presented itself. He wanted to send a message that he could be tough and he couldn't distinguish between Qasem Soleimani and other prominent militant leaders in the region. So he went for it. And I think it was only after the fact, seeing just what the reaction was, both inside Iran and in the region as a whole, the enormity of that action, I think, only sunk in Washington after the fact. Whether it was counterproductive or not, there's nothing that emerged after that that showed that Iran was all of a sudden acting in a far more brazen way. They have been biding their time. And even though at the time they threatened that they would react in a proportionate and devastating manner, they haven't yet done so. So I think that is a fairly good indication of ultimately a very low capacity country that doesn't have much military might when it comes to projecting power beyond its immediate vicinity, yet one that has been built up as almost a hegemonic regional power in the Middle East, which I think has been a wrong way of characterizing the Islamic Republic by various administrations, not just the Trump administration. I think depicting Iran as an all-powerful regional hegemon has vastly overstated their ability to actually shoot back when there's an action such as the assassination of Qasem Soleimani. And also, as the previous questions brought up, how under-resourced they are fundamentally, given the range of domestic worries they have in terms of the devastation of the economy and Iran's environment, to be able to shore up enough resources to hit back in any meaningful way.
Hussein Banai is professor of international studies at the Hamilton Lugar School of Global and International Studies at Indiana University. Thank you for your terrific insights and your time.
Thank you very much for those wonderful questions.
Press Conference USA on the Voice of America was produced in Washington with technical assistance from Rick Pantaleo. And joining me on the program was Siamak Dehanpour, senior broadcaster in VOA's Persian service. I'm Carol Castiel. Join me again next week for another Press Conference USA on the Voice of America.